This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Basically, our message is that unsafe water is as deadly to severely malnourished children as lack of food.
That's UNICEF spokesperson Najwa Miki warning about the effects of unsafe water in countries facing drought and famine. Details coming up.
Also, more than 3,000 people a day are fleeing drought-stricken areas of Somalia in search of food and water. And there's another meningitis outbreak in Nigeria.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the United Nations has confirmed two of its employees were killed in the Democratic Republic of Congo and said it will open an investigation into the deaths. For VOA, William Clowes has the latest from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
The United Nations mission in the DRC, known as MONUSCO, held a news conference on Wednesday morning. MONUSCO's Director of Public Information, Charles Bambara, confirmed that two bodies discovered on Monday in Kasai Central province are those of UN employees.
Nous espérons que la cause de leur mort sera déterminée à la suite d'un examen plus approfondi.
Reading a statement from the Secretary General of the UN, Bambara expressed hope that the cause of their deaths will be determined following a thorough investigation. He called on the Congolese authorities to conduct a full inquiry and said that the UN would launch its own.
En cas d'acte criminel, les Nations Unies feront tout leur possible pour assurer.
If the inquiry uncovers criminal acts, Bambara said, the UN will do everything to ensure that justice is done. Michael Sharp, an American, and Zaida Catalin from Sweden were working for the UN Group of Experts, a six-member body which researches conflict in the DRC and reports directly to the Secretary General. They and four Congolese nationals accompanying them disappeared on March 12th in a remote part of the Kasai region. This is an area where since August 2016, the DRC military has been involved in an increasingly deadly conflict with a militia known as Kamwina Nsapu. The government has already blamed the militia for the disappearance of the six. Bambara also said that the UN, along with the European Union, African Union and Organization of La Francophonie, appealed to President Joseph Kabila's ruling alliance and the opposition to urgently implement a deal they signed on New Year's Eve. The agreement is a roadmap for delayed elections to be held in December 2017 and Kabila's departure from office. However, the two sides have been unable to resolve their differences on how best to implement the accord, and the Catholic bishops who are mediating have walked away from the stalled talks.
Les organisations ont souligné l'urgence de la mise en œuvre effective afin de faciliter le processus.
The implementation of the deal, Bambara said, will help facilitate the stabilization of the country, the restoration of law and order, and the holding of elections within the planned time frame. The DRC's main opposition party has called for nationwide protests on April 10th against what it says is Kabila's plan to create a presidency for life. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
In other news on the DRC, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, says U.N. peacekeepers are aiding a government that is corrupt and preys on its citizens. She says the DRC government is inflicting predatory behavior against its own people and that U.N. members should have the decency and common sense to end this. There are growing tensions in the DRC over whether President Joseph Kabila intends to step down next year as part of a political agreement.
More than 3,000 people a day are fleeing drought-stricken areas of Somalia in search of food and water. That's according to the Norwegian Refugee Council, which describes the situation as the highest displacement since the 2011 famine. NRC Country Director Victor Moses says there are clear hallmarks of a catastrophe in the making and warns now is the chance to avert a famine. About 6 million people in Somalia need emergency food aid. That includes about 1 million children. Families in rural areas have abandoned their dying cattle to bring too big for food in urban areas. But the NRC says where food is available, prices are surging. The NRC says there is no relief in sight. Forecasts say rainfall between April and June will be below average. Also, cholera has spread to much of the country. At least 11,000 cases have been reported since the beginning of the year, with nearly 270 deaths. Many Somalis have crossed the border into Ethiopia, but drought is also affecting that area.
A UN agency says famine or famine-like conditions in South Sudan, Somalia, northeast Nigeria, and Yemen are being made worse by unsafe water. UNICEF says the problem creates a vicious cycle from which many children never recover. Najwa Miki is a spokesperson for UNICEF from New York. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about worsening conditions in the four countries.
What we're seeing is that obviously there are really high levels of severe acute malnutrition among children. We estimate that the number of children who are severely malnourished is close to 1.4 million. But what we're also seeing is severe shortages of water, of hygiene, of adequate sanitation, and we're concerned that this actually is exacerbating the situation of malnourished children. We estimate that there is 27 million people in northeast Nigeria, in Somalia, in South Sudan, and in Yemen who do not have regular access to safe water, who do not have regular access to adequate sanitation facilities, who do not have regular access to hygiene items like soap. Considering the circumstances and the water shortages, the risk that the malnourished children would die is really high. Basically, our message is that unsafe water is as deadly to severely malnourished children as lack of food.
Give us an idea of what unsafe water does in drought situations.
If you're malnourished, and if you have diarrhea on top of it from drinking water that is not safe, and if you're a child, then your ability to keep food down is severely diminished. So unsafe water, in a way, can be a cause of malnutrition, but it can also be an exacerbating factor. It makes it worse. So the body becomes extremely weak. The child cannot keep any food down. And as a result, no matter how much nutritious food you try to give to a child who's malnourished, if they're not drinking water that is safe, then that's not going to help. The risk of death is equally, if not more, high. So it is really important that when we provide assistance, and this is what UNICEF is doing in all these four countries, when we provide assistance, we are providing the nutritious food, but we're also trying to make sure that there is enough safe water to drink.
So northeast Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen all have conflict or high levels of insecurity. So how do you go about solving these problems under those conditions?
What we try to do, we work with partners and we work also directly on the ground. We're pretty much implementing direct work on the ground in all of these countries. And what we try to do is provide the access to safe water, for example, by helping with water trucking, by providing water treatment tablets, setting up better sanitation facilities, but also all the work we do with communities to raise awareness about hygiene practices. What we see, for example, in a number of these countries, because of their lack of access to safe and adequate sanitation, open defecation is pretty common, and so the limited water sources and rivers that are available become contaminated, and that's how diseases like cholera and watery diarrhea spread out. And we've noticed in three of these countries, in Somalia, in Yemen, and South Sudan, we've noticed increasing cases of cholera, for example. I think in Somalia, it's up to five times higher than it was at this time last year. So it's important that we also provide treatment for diarrhea and for acute watery diarrhea for the children who are affected.
Now, although you have been working in these countries, since these conflicts began, has your access been limited?
Unfortunately, because of the conflict situation that is characteristic of all of these four countries, access is a serious and important issue. We know that we can make a difference in the areas that we are able to reach, and we've seen that in northeast Nigeria, for example. But there are places that are beyond the reach of humanitarian workers. You've seen reports over the weekend about some aid workers who were killed in South Sudan, and it's exactly situations like this which hinder our ability to reach the populations most in need. The worst rates of severe malnutrition are in the areas that are extremely difficult for humanitarians, not to say impossible for humanitarians, to get access to.
Najwa Miki is a spokesperson for UNICEF from New York. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa.
Here in Washington, a congressional subcommittee heard complaints yesterday that U.S. aid programs are at risk of getting slashed or eliminated under the proposed Trump administration budget. The cuts are being proposed during a time when the threat of famine in East Africa is the highest it has been in decades. Ayan Buor reports from Washington.
At the hearing of the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa, panelists warned that U.S. budget cuts could undermine efforts to address the consequences of drought and crisis-driven famine at a time when aid agencies are attempting to scale up efforts to prevent millions from dying. In prepared remarks submitted to the committee, panelist Faustine Wabwire, Senior Foreign Assistance Policy Advisor for the Bread for the World Institute, said the proposed budget cuts risk slashing or eliminating the very accounts that finance the U.S. government's emergency response. These include the Food for Peace, International Disaster Assistance, and the Migration and Refugee Assistance Programs of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID.
We know that the administration has proposed about 30% cuts to State Department and USAID. And from what we know, the role of these institutions, there will definitely be negative implications.
Matthew Nims, acting director of the Food for Peace office, told lawmakers the president's blueprint does not specifically mention cuts to his office and that he cannot measure the potential impacts of the proposed budget cuts.
I feel that it's my job to make sure that with the resources we're given by Congress as it goes through, that we make the tough choices that are going to be there in the future and that we continue to stress the most vulnerable and the most needy in the world.
The Famine Early Warning Systems Network reports an estimated 70 million people in 45 countries will need emergency food assistance this year. Famine has already been declared in parts of South Sudan, and more than 20 million people are at credible risk of famine in Nigeria, Somalia, and Yemen over the next 6 months, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UNOCHA. The Food for Peace program, established in July 1954, provides emergency food aid and development food assistance to tens of millions of people in dozens of countries each year, according to its website. The USAID program receives most of its funding through the government's Title II grant, which administers both emergency and development resources. Its other major source of funding is the International Disaster Assistance Account, or IDA, which allows Food for Peace to buy foods locally, regionally, and provide voucher programs and market-based interventions. Panelist Michael Bowers, Mercy Corps' Vice President of Humanitarian Leadership and Response, advised lawmakers to fully fund IDA and Food for Peace, adding that is one step Congress can take to prevent the spread of famine and create conditions that mitigate food crises.
If we fail to respond now, we risk a much larger and costly emergency response later, with too many lives lost in the meantime. Although funding is also needed across the region, we are barely scratching the surface of what we've had.
Subcommittee Chairman Chris Smith, a Republican from New Jersey, told VOA after the hearing that he is unhappy with the president's budget blueprint as it stands, adding that he does not like the big cuts and his goal is to get it right.
The world is in crisis. There's humanitarian needs. The number of people of concern to the High Commissioner for the UNHCR, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, is at an all-time high. There's crises everywhere, and we need to do more to try to help people in need.
UNOCHA says more than $5.6 billion is needed to prevent a major humanitarian disaster. Of that amount, only about $1 billion has been committed. Ayan Buor, VOA News, Washington.
A new study sheds light on how to find water in water-scarce areas. It was conducted in Africa's vast Namib Desert, one of the world's oldest and most biologically diverse deserts. Scientists from Indiana University went to the desert to explore the potential of water other than rainfall. They say they are the first to report that the ocean is not the sole source of life-sustaining fog and dew for numerous plants and animals in the desert. They say this knowledge will help scientists predict the availability of non-rainfall water in the Namib and elsewhere. Professor Lixin Wang is the lead scientist of the study. He says researchers may be able to determine ways to harvest this water during drought situations. He spoke with me about the findings.
Our study mainly focuses on non-rainfall waters. Non-rainfall waters such as fog and dew at least studies and at least characterized component of hydrological cycle. This is because their amount typically very small compared with rainfall. At the same time, they supply critical amount of water for dryland ecosystems, and they often mean life and death for many organisms living in water stress environments. Despite of their importance, there are still many basic questions that we don't know the answer regarding non-rainfall waters. For example, where do they come from? How do we know that? How do we differentiate different components of non-rainfall water, such as fog and dew? So our study aimed to answer these basic questions. So we conducted our observation in the Namib Desert, which is one of the most well-known fog-dominated deserts in the world. We developed a new framework to pinpoint the source of non-rainfall waters. We also developed a new isotope-based technique to differentiate fog and dew formation for the first time.
How was this research funded, and also, were there any surprises from your research?
This study was supported through two grants from the National Science Foundation. One is from the Office of International Science and Engineering, which is a seed grant to help us establish new international collaborations. Another grant is from the Hydrological Science Program of the NSF, National Science Foundation. So the biggest surprise, for me at least, is the source of non-rainfall water. The Namib Desert is a coastal desert. Like many other coastal deserts in the world, it's very natural for us to assume most of the fog should be coming from the ocean. However, based on our 1 full year's observation and analysis, we found that more than half of the fog water was not from the ocean. They are actually from the local sources, such as the groundwater and soil water. This is definitely the biggest surprise to me, and it's also very interesting. This has very important implications to predict the availability of non-rainfall water in the future. However, I have to say, like many other studies, we wish we had a longer data record, and we do plan to do longer-term observations to further investigate the trend.
How large is this Namib Desert, and what countries does it encompass?
The exact spatial extent of Namib Desert is actually under debate, but it's actually very large area. It's probably more than 1,000 miles from south to north. It's actually like a long stripe along the coast. So it starts from, typically it's from Angola, and it goes through Angola, Namibia, South Africa. No matter what the debate is, it's a very, very massive piece of land.
Given the current drought situation in some parts of Africa, how can these findings help in water scarcity situations?
I guess our study won't directly solve the water scarcity problem, but our findings do have implications on the water scarcity issues. Many parts of Africa has been reported to have a frequent fog and dew occurrence, such as places in Namibia, South Africa, Kenya, or Tanzania. So these places are either close to the ocean or they are in mountain areas. So this indicates non-rainfall water could potentially serve as a supplemental water sources for community use in these places. Our study provides a new framework to identify the source of non-rainfall waters. Knowing exactly where the non-rainfall water comes from will help us predict the availability of non-rainfall water in the future. With this knowledge, we may be able to determine ways to harvest these novel water sources in different parts of Africa and around the world.
Lixin Wang is an assistant professor of earth sciences at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He was also the lead scientist of the study in the Namib Desert.
There's another meningitis outbreak in Nigeria. Health officials report more than 1,800 cases over the past 5 months and nearly 270 deaths. AFP reports the outbreak is affecting 15 states, with most of the cases in the northern state of Sokoto, Zamfara, Katsina, Obi, and Niger, as well as the federal capital territory. Officials have labeled it an epidemic in those areas. The World Health Organization says children between the ages of 5 and 14 are the most affected group in the meningitis outbreak. A vaccine program is underway. Nigeria and neighboring Niger were both hit hard by the disease in 2015, with nearly 14,000 cases and more than 1,100 deaths.
Music. Scientists have made a discovery that could lead to new treatments for African sleeping sickness. The disease is transmitted by the bite of the tsetse fly, which injects parasites called trypanosomes. The symptoms of sleeping sickness include muscle weakness, fever, itching, and so-called sleep inversion. That's when normal rhythms are reversed and a victim becomes drowsy but day and awake at night. But according to a new study published in the journal Nature Microbiology, the parasite that causes sleeping sickness has its own internal clock. Its rhythms can be interrupted to make medicines against sleeping sickness more effective. One of the co-leaders of the study is Professor Joseph Takahashi, chair of the neuroscience department at the O'Donnell Brain Institute at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips about the disease and the research.
If the disease is not treated, unfortunately, it is fatal. It's a very serious disease, especially in Africa, where tens of millions of people are at risk for this infection.
Tell me a little bit about how it actually operates. I understand there's a parasite.
Yes, so there's a parasite that's transmitted by the tsetse fly. When it bites a person, then the parasite can go into the bloodstream. It then reproduces and proliferates and then spreads throughout the body. The parasite can actually penetrate into the brain, where it causes very serious symptoms and eventually can cause death.
So tell me a little bit about what you discovered in terms of the sleep rhythms of the actual parasite.
So it's kind of a two-way street. We know that the parasite can disrupt our sleep-wake patterns, and we were curious whether the parasite also had its own clock and whether it might use its clock for being, say, more efficient at infection or being present when the tsetse fly is present, because the tsetse fly also has a diurnal rhythm. It doesn't bite all the time of day. It bites at particular times of day. And so in this study, what we did is we asked, can we find genes in the parasite that have a 24-hour change in expression, meaning the levels of those genes are fluctuating with the rhythm? Even in people, we have our own 24-hour clocks, and we now know that those clocks are regulated by gene program that's in every cell in our body. And so we are asking whether the trypanosome has a clock like that, and this paper shows that it does.
And what were you able to conclude from that that will help people who might be at risk for this disease?
We can isolate the parasite so it doesn't have any cues from either the human or the animal host or the tsetse fly. And then what we did is we measured the expression of its genes. And then we can ask, do any of those genes have a 24-hour cycle? And what we found is about 10% of the genes did. We found the metabolism of the trypanosome, the parasite, had two peaks of high metabolic activity. We then asked whether the parasite was more sensitive to drug treatment at a particular time of day. And in fact, we found that the trypanosome is much more sensitive to the drug at one time of day than at other times when its metabolism is higher. And so that could be important in the treatment of sleeping sickness, because you always want to use a dose of drug that has fewer side effects to the host, but is more efficacious on the parasite. It shows that the time that you give the medication might be important for infectious disease, and this might extend to many other kinds of parasitic diseases.
That was Professor Joseph Takahashi, chair of neuroscience at the O'Donnell Brain Institute in Texas. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rashard Smith, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am your host Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, 20 million people are suffering from a hunger crisis. An in-depth discussion on the international call for action on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.